and I give you Brenda.
Yay. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brenda.
Hi, Brenda.
And I'm going to stand up for two reasons. One, my sponsor says it's easier to tell a lie sitting down than it is standing up. Okay. And number two is out of respect, because I respect this program and the people in it. And it's my way of saying thank you. Thank you for giving me back my life. And thank you, Alverna, for asking me. It's an honor to be asked by you. This lady has been instrumental in my life for many, many years. And she's taken certain actions that's helped save my life in more ways than one, not just alcohol. So being asked to do this is really an honor. So I get to share a little bit of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I can tell you that this story is mine, and I'll be bringing in some things that might be a little bit more than just alcohol, but I'll touch it very lightly because it is Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous is where my sobriety lays. I was born to the parents of, my father was a master sergeant in the Army, and my mother didn't work at the time, and we traveled a lot because he was always getting relocated. I didn't know a lot of things about my childhood. I don't remember a lot of things about my childhood. But I do remember we went to Okinawa, and I remember being in second grade, and I was standing in the graveyard, I mean in the playground, and I felt apart from. I remember standing by the swing and watching all the other kids over swinging and playing, and I felt like I was 100 miles away, and I was not a part of at all. And I didn't know what was going on. I just felt very strange. And it only lasted a couple of minutes. And then I just said, okay, and I ran down and joined the other kids. But I know that now that was a part of my disease talking at that time, because I was not comfortable in this world. I was not comfortable at all. I was very uncomfortable. And I would try to fit in, and I never felt like I truly, truly fit in. And I kept growing and getting older, and we kept moving. And finally, my father got transferred to Nashville, Tennessee, and he was on recruiting duty, and I went to my very first public school. Now, I got to start school at the age of 5 because my dad was military. They let me go in. And then when we came back from Okinawa, and then I had to go to school in Nashville, and I had to take a test to get back into public school. And they moved me up a grade. So here I'm running 2 years ahead of the kids that were my age. I mean, the kids in my school, in my grade, were 2 years ahead of me. So that's where they had privileges I didn't have, because my mother said it's not age appropriate. I couldn't go. I couldn't do it. So when other kids started dating, I'm still sitting at home. And I was getting very resentful. And as I got resentful, I got rebellious. And the more rebellious I got, the more I would step out to try to do things against my parents. Now, I was too scared to really lie and sneak out of the skating rink or anything like that. So I'd get really devious in other ways. I started smoking. And I figured, you know, I'm rebelling. I'm smoking. And I would hide my cigarettes. You know, they never suspected. And so then when I was 16, my parents always tried to give me everything I wanted. My dad gave me a car when I was 14, but I couldn't drive because I didn't have a driver's license. So it sat in the driveway for 2 years. So when I turned 16, I didn't like that car anymore because it was old. I'd never driven it, but he got me another car. And I started driving this car, and as I started driving this car, I would drive to school and I'd pick up other kids on the way. And I always picked up the kids that were ready to go out and have fun. And so I finally got to go out and have fun with them, and they were drinking. So why not? Why not? Yeah, I could join right in. And I did. And as I did that, I felt a part of. I took that first drink, and I fit in completely and wholly for the first time in my life. I fit in. And I kept on doing that. Now, I graduated from high school early, of course, and I started college when I just wasn't even 17 yet. And I went up there for my first semester. My boyfriend from home drove up because it was only an hour drive from my house. I was in Murfreesboro State University. I don't think it was even a university then. It was still a college because it's been that long. But he came up that night, and we went out, and naturally we were drinking. And I wasn't drunk, but I was feeling pretty good, and he was too, and he wrecked the car. He hit a tree, and we had to get a tow truck, and I was late getting back to the dorm. So my very first night there, I was in trouble. My very first night there, I got campus. I had to go see the dean of women Now, I didn't know it, but the dean of women at this particular college turned out to be my old geometry teacher from high school. She had just taken the job. I walked in, and I skipped her class a whole year. I flunked the last half of geometry because I wouldn't go to my first period class. You know, and of course, I faked my report card, so my parents didn't know it. And I walk in, and she's like, "Already?" And I'm like, "Yes." So they had to call my parents up there. At that time, the kids in college didn't get quite as much leeway as they do now, because I'm talking many years ago. And my dad had to come up, and he had to be told that I was drinking. That's the first hint he ever had of me drinking. So as he did this, he found out a lot of other stuff, too, about my high school days that I didn't intend for him to find out. But, of course, you know, with her being my old teacher in high school, he found out. So I got campus, and I couldn't go anywhere on campus. I couldn't go join in the fun for 2 weeks, which was pretty mild. So I was making the classes and making grades, and then my 2 weeks was up, and I hit the floor running. And I was out the door, and I was meeting these college boys, and no strings attached. You know, all I made sure I was in my dorm room every night on time, and I would sneak in. I put a lot of chewing gum in my mouth so they wouldn't smell booze. And I did really good up until about 2 weeks before school's out. And I got offered White Lightning for the first time. And I took a sip of White Lightning. And it burned. It was horrible. It burned. And this guy goes, "Oh, you're a novice." And I'll show you. So I kept drinking it. And I don't remember that night. I don't remember. I remember starting to come around in my room. And I didn't have on the same clothes I had on when I left. And I didn't know what was going on. And they said, "You know, you're in trouble." And I said, "What?" They said, "Well, you got caught trying to get in." And one of the older girls had been out with us, and she saw the shape I was in, and she took charge. And I had fallen down in the cow pasture, and I was all muddy. And she had gone back to the dorm and got some of my clothes, came back. They got me changed, and she was trying to get me in. And we got caught. And there it was again. This is my last 2 weeks. I was campused again. No more. But I didn't get invited back for the next semester either. So that was a very short-lived college career. So I went back home to live with my parents. And I'm still, you know, I'm 17 years old. I'm 17. I'm already kicked out of college. And I'm back at home with my parents looking for a job. And I don't want to have to follow rules. I still don't want to have to follow rules. So the next best thing to do to get out of that house, I tried to move out. Now, this is, like I say, a while back, and, you know, at 17, I wasn't allowed to go. You had to be 18. But my parents didn't say a word. They let me pack my bags. They let me leave. I told them where I'd be. Said, "See you later." And I went to this place. I went to this apartment that I was staying with two other girls that I worked with. And the next morning, my father's there with two policemen. And he says, "You're going home." And I said, "But you said I could." He said, "I never said anything. You just did it." He said, "I'll show you what you can and can't do." He says, "I have you till you're 18, whether you like it or not." So here I am. I'm working. I'm making money. Why can't I do what I want to do? So I didn't want to wait till I was 18. So what do? You find somebody. You get pregnant. You get married. I didn't have to live at home anymore. So, of course, that didn't work out. You know, he was 24. I was just turning 18 when the baby was born. And, you know, I'd left him a month before the baby was even born. There I am, back home with my parents again. And I still don't like being back home with my parents. So I picked up with a high school boyfriend that he was quite a few years ahead of me because he was a friend of one of my boyfriends in school who was ahead of me. And we got married. He was 24. I was 19. So here it is. I'm on my second marriage. He's a really nice guy. You know, he takes great care of me and my baby. But I wanted to drink. He wanted to go to church. No figure. You know, so who's going to win? You know, I'm going to win. And I would leave the baby with him and I'd take off for church. I mean, for drinking while he went to church. So it got really, really bad. And while I was out doing my drinking in crowds, and I met somebody else. And I went home one day and I said, "You know what? I need a divorce. We've been married about 6 months." And he said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, I've met somebody else and I want to get married." And he goes, "But you are married." And I said, "Well, I want to get married to him." So he said, "Well, I want to meet him." So he takes me over to this other guy's house that I'm going to marry. He comes out. I introduce him. He tells this guy, take care of me. He leaves. I stay. My mother gets my baby. I get a divorce, and I marry this third guy. And, you know, here I am. I'm not even 20 years old, and I've been married three times, and I have a baby. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm going to have another baby. And I don't want to quit drinking. I quit drinking the whole time I was pregnant. But, you know, as soon as I had the baby, I'm right back at my old tricks. Now, my third husband was a lot, I don't know how to explain it. He put up with me, and I still don't know why to this day he put up with me. And I stayed married to him for a little over 10 years. I ran around the whole time. You know, he had responsibility of paying the bills. He had responsibility of holding down the job, taking care of two children, taking care of a household, washing clothes, washing dishes, and saying hi to me as I came through. That was his job. And I still don't understand it. But this is what I did. And during that time, I was introduced to other substances, too. And I was mixing everything. You know, I did these other things, too. But I tell you what, alcohol was there in the beginning. Alcohol was there through it. Alcohol was there when that part ended. So I know where my problem lies. It lies with alcohol, you know. So when I was doing this other stuff, I started getting in trouble with the police. Now, I hadn't been in trouble with the police before. And then I started getting in trouble with the police. Well, I got to the point where for about a year there, I was spending every weekend getting locked up. And I'd always leave the house on Friday night with money in my pocket to make bond, because I know I'd get it. It'd be public drunk, fighting, or, you know, something like that. But I'd always bond out. You know, I'd be home ready to go the next night and pay the fine and go on. I didn't think about it because I had a husband that made money. Go figure. So I was doing this on a regular basis, and I did this until the judge got tired of looking at me. And I got into some serious trouble with this other stuff. And to put a long story short, I wound up having to serve some time in Georgia Women's Correctional Institute. I didn't like it, and I didn't want to go back there. So when I got out, I made up my mind, never again. They let me out at 9 o'clock in the morning. I said, I will never drink again. I will never drug again. And I meant it. But, you know, my girlfriend picked me up at 9 o'clock in the morning. She had a 12-pack in the back seat. I was drunk by noon, and I was doing other things by 6. That's how long it took. And then it dawned on me what I was doing, and it dawned on me what I went to prison for, which was those other things. So I would quit those other things, and drinking is okay because it's legal. And I did quit those other things. I used to say I quit. I got to make an amends for that. And this is why I have to say this every time I speak. I didn't quit voluntarily. My friends would still come over and give it to me, and I would do it, but I quit paying for it. That's what I did. Because, see, when I went to prison, it's because I was the one selling it, so I quit doing that, and I quit buying. So if I do that, I'm not going to get in any trouble. Well, when that happens, these friends quit showing up because you don't pay back, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, expectations. And they quit killing them, and I quit because nobody offered it to me, and I wasn't going to pay for it. But my drinking tripled. My drinking got that much worse. So my third husband stuck by me through all this until I wouldn't stay at home again. I think that was the last time that I went out for a pack of cigarettes and came home 2 weeks later. Mm-hmm. And he was finally done with it, you know. And he said, you've got to stay at home. And I said, no, I don't. I packed and I moved. And I remarried again. I married a guy that was 24 years old. Because every time I got married, my husband was 24. And at this time, I was 31, something like that. I married another 24-year-old. And then this 24-year-old, I stayed with him for a few years, and we drank a lot together. We played a lot, you know. And I kept getting worse and worse in my drinking. It kept getting more and more. And it got to the point where he didn't want to be around me that much either. So, you know, that's the easiest fix right there. I can get a divorce. Well, he didn't want me to get a divorce. He wasn't quite ready to go yet. And I said, no, I'm going to move to Florida. So I had two roommates. I packed them up. We all went to Florida. We went to Melbourne, actually. And I was managing a restaurant by this time. Because, see, by this time, that third husband isn't supporting me anymore, and I got to work. And I started waitressing. And I started waitressing at a place called Waffle House. Anybody heard of it? Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I was one of those Waffle House waitresses. Started on third shift. We have a reputation. It's earned. We deserve it. The thing about it, you know, when I got there, I wanted to go into management, and I took a lie detector test to prove I wasn't playing with those other substances anymore. So I got into management. They let me in, even with my record, they let me in. And so I started managing, and I was managing the restaurant there, and I was still drinking. I was doing really well at drinking, but I was doing really well on my job, too, because if you give me something hard to do, I'll work real hard till I get it done. Once it gets easy, I lose interest and I get in trouble. It's just that simple. That's what I did. So I was working hard, and they liked the way I was working, so they moved me to Daytona to manage the shop there on Volusia Avenue. Now, I had it during bike week. I was rolling during bike week. I mean, you know, I was partying all night and working all day, and I mean, it was just great, I thought. You know, my life was just wonderful. But see, there was something missing. I needed a boyfriend. So I met this little guy. They made me a district manager. I went to Fort Pierce, and I met this guy that was working for me. He was 24. And at this time, I was 44 when we got married. He was 24 when we got married. And we stayed married for about 10, you know, we were together for like 10 years. Because actually I met him when he was 20. I married him when he was 24. So, you know, it was going through there, and I thought everything was okay. I thought my life was wonderful. I didn't see what the alcohol was doing to me. I really did not see it. With my fifth husband, we took off and went to California. We came back through Myrtle Beach. We went all around. My mom got sick. We moved back here. My mom got sick in 1995. And my dad called and said, your mom has cancer, and she doesn't have long. So we packed everything up and moved to Atlanta, Georgia, because that way we could be close to North Carolina to get up to see her. And, you know, my drinking was so bad that when we got to Atlanta and I was supposed to take my weekends and my time to go to spend with my mother, which was only less than a three-hour drive, in that year, about almost 9 months, I only made it up there to see her twice because I could not leave my alcohol. And I kept justifying everything I was doing by saying, I'll go next week, I'll go next week. And then I got the call one night. My father had called me. My mom had just passed away. And we thought she had more time. But her heart burst. And there I was, half drunk, sitting in my living room. And they're telling me that my mother just died. And my husband had to drive us to North Carolina. We wound up arguing the whole way because I couldn't give him directions, and he was getting mad, and I understand that. And we left Atlanta at 2 o'clock in the morning. We should have been there by 5. We didn't pull in there till 9 because I couldn't get there. And we pulled in, and my dad came out to hug me, and I know now what he smelled when he hugged me. I didn't know it then. But I didn't drink during that week. We were preparing for the funeral. And my kids came over. And because, see, my kids had been living with my mom this whole time. Because it's drinking. I couldn't take care of kids. I let them go to my mother. And so, you know, we had the funeral. I didn't drink that whole week. And after we buried my mother, we got back to my dad's house. And my dad was very upset, of course. And I left. I said, okay, we have to go home. I have to get back to work. And I didn't. But I left because I had to get down the road. It was a dry county, and I had to get to that other county, and I had to go have a drink. I had to have a drink. I was past the point of being able to drink for fun. I was drinking just to be normal. I was drinking to get right, and that's all I was doing. And that was really the beginning of the worst 2 years of my life. In that 2 years' time, I stayed so drunk, it's a wonder I held on to my job. I had already been busted down from district manager to manager. Finally, I said, I don't like this company anymore. I went with Red Lobster, and I was waitressing. And being a waitress at Red Lobster, we had 50 servers to call on, and there's usually 25 to 30 working a shift. So if you lay out, you can get somebody else to go in, and that's the only thing that kept a job for me, because I would get somebody else to go in for me. And I would work maybe 3 days a week, and they would schedule me 5. But I couldn't get there. And my husband was getting more and more aggravated with me. So I remember for 2 years, my life was getting off from work, going home, getting drunk. I quit even going to bars. I just went home to drink. And he'd want to go out, and I couldn't. I had to go home and drink because it's cheaper that way. I can get drunk quicker, and I didn't have to worry about driving. And we got there, and I would drink. I would drink until I passed out. Some nights I would take two drinks and be drunk. Some nights I'd watch the sun come up and still wouldn't feel like I was drunk. So neither one of those places was acceptable. I'd never hit that happy place in my drinking at all. And so we went out on May the 5th. He taught me into going out. We went out on May the 5th for Cinco de Mayo. Everybody parties on Cinco de Mayo. Well, we got into a big argument and went home. And I was going to finish my drinking there. And we got into another big argument. And he says, I can't do it anymore. He said, it's not that I love you. I can't do it anymore. And he said, we've been together 10 years. He said, you have never told me you were wrong. You have never apologized. And I'm sitting on a couch listening to him say this to me, and my head says, that's because even when I was wrong, you were more wrong than I was, and I don't have to. You know. And I remember thinking this. And he went upstairs, he came back down, he says, I'm done, and he walked out the door. And that was absolutely, you know, I don't know if I really loved him or not. I have no idea. But when he walked out that door, it's like everything in my life was gone. Because my father wasn't talking to me anymore by that time. My kids had quit talking to me years ago. You know, I'm an only child, so I had no brothers or sisters. My cousin, who was the only person in my family that was even close to me that lived in Kissimmee, wouldn't even come to see me anymore. She sided with that no good husband that walked out. How dare she, you know? So here I was, and I just locked myself in my house. I'd get up in the morning. I would go replenish my alcohol supply. I would sit down and start drinking, call into work, start drinking, and then I would go, it's okay, I'm okay today. My phone would ring, I'd let the answering machine get it. People would knock on my door, I'd peek out the window, I don't want to talk to them. And I figured if it was important, I'd call them back. Nothing was ever important enough to get me to call them back. And I just kept drinking and drinking and drinking. On May the 13th, I stood up in the middle of my living room, and I don't know what happened to me that day. I don't know why that day was picked. It wasn't my idea, it was God's idea. I stood up in the middle of my living room, and I said, God help me. And for the first time in my life, I didn't tell God what to do to help me. I was 49 and a half years old, and I didn't know what to do. I sat down, and I just started doing what felt right, and I picked up the phone, and I started calling all these hospitals because I knew I had to get away from alcohol. And I got a girl on the hotline here, and she told me to go over to the Westside Club, and I did. And I walked in, and three girls there got hold of me after that first meeting because I was leaving to go get some more booze because I didn't hear anything that was said. And they came to my house and talked to me, and they got me into a detox that night. And I was in that detox until May the 19th. I walked out of there, came right back to the Westside Club, and I was there at my first meeting that I was sober enough to understand what was happening. And I've been there ever since. And that's not because I've done everything so right. It's because by the grace of God, I lost that obsession to drink. And my obsession to be crazy was still there. You know, I was still just as crazy as the bed bug, but I didn't have to drink over it. I was given that period of grace to be able to get something done, to have some tools, to learn something about God, to be able to stay sober. And what I found for me was that I was the stubborn sort, you know. I was really the stubborn sort. I thought just sitting in that room, I was going to stay sober. And I got a sponsor because y'all told me to get a sponsor. I started drinking coffee because you told me that y'all drank coffee, you know. Nobody told me you could drink and go to a meeting, so I didn't. And I wanted to, but I didn't. You know, I didn't have the obsession, so I didn't go get it. And I started trying to listen to my sponsor, and I go, yeah. I know. Yeah, I know. You know, that kind of thing. And at 9 months sober, I'd given lip service to steps 1, 2, and 3, just so I could get her off my back, you know. And she kept saying, well, when are you going to write for her? When are you going to write for her? And I kept saying, I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it. Because, see, I didn't want to put that down on paper. If I put that on paper, I'm going to have to tell somebody about it. And if you know what I did, you'll throw me out of AA. And that's the only place that was talking to me. That's the only place that was talking to me. And so I didn't want to do that, and I wasn't willing. And at 9 months sober, what I found is I hit a place where I was either going to put a bullet in my head, go get drunk, or do the work. And I have no idea how it came to the way it did. I went home one night after work, and I sat there, and I said, I don't want to die. And I pulled out a pencil and paper, and I started writing, and I started writing. And I wrote every night for about 5 nights. And I called Polly, and I said, I wrote your damn fifth step, the fourth step. And she goes, oh, okay. She said, you're off tomorrow. I'll be there at 9, have a coffee on. I'm like, well, wait a minute. You know, don't we need to talk? She said, no. She said, I'll be there. So she got there, and she said, now I want you to talk to me about all that stuff you wrote. I said, okay. She said, before we start, she says, tell me the worst thing you ever did. And I don't know what happened. It came out. I didn't write it down. I did not have it written down because I knew if I told her, she'd walk out on me. But I said it. And when I did, she didn't walk out. She leaned over, actually leaned over, put her arm around me and said, you poor thing, you've had to live with that for so long. And I bawled. And I told her about the rest of it. And I felt empty. I thought when I did that, I was supposed to get this weight off of me, and I'm going to be free, and everything's going to be wonderful. And I felt empty. I didn't understand it. And she told me to go take that hour by myself and to go back over and review my work. And I did. And what I found was I thought I'd done everything to the best of my ability, but I still felt empty, and it scared me. And I called her, and I said, why am I so empty? I don't get it. I said, everybody talks about this freedom they get at step 5. And she said, well, have you ever thought about the fact that when we talked, you took all that old stuff and you put it on the table to look at it? She said, you are empty. She said, now what you put back in depends on you. You can put that same stuff right back in. You can go back to doing all that same stuff you used to do. You can still have the same thoughts, still have the same problems. But you can also go into 6 and 7, start putting something different in, and start doing something different. So the next day we got together, we did 6 and 7. And when I did 8 and 9, it was a face-to-face thing. Because I was told, you did the crime in person, you got to go do it, fix it right in person. And I was told to get a little card like this, write down what I'm going to say, clear it with my sponsor first, go say it. When I got to the end of that card, shut up. Because this isn't about me turning around and saying, yeah, but you did. Yeah, but you. This is about them telling me what I need to do to set right what I did, not what they did. And I did this to the best of my ability. And it's so funny because one lady I didn't think I would ever, ever have to see was my old boss at the Waffle House. And I didn't think I'd ever have to see her. And this is just how God works. I mean, it's just God has just been doing these things in my life that's miraculous. I was sitting in a Waffle House eating with Mark, as a matter of fact. And this lady came over to wait on us, and it was my old boss. And I'm like, this isn't even the right Waffle House, you know. And I said, Louise, could I see you in the back a minute? And she said, well, yeah. So we walked back there, and I said, you know, I really need to set right the wrongs I did with you. I said, I'm in a program of recovery now. In order for me to stay sober, I really need to find out what I can do to set right what I did. I said, I lied to you. I didn't show up for work. I put you in a hard place too many times. And she just grinned and put her arm around me. She says, we all knew you as a drunk, but you're the best cook I had. I'm like, oh, okay. So she came back out. She's smiling. I'm smiling. She's waiting on us, and I'm talking to her. I left there feeling really good. Really good. And about 2 years later, I was invited to speak at a clubhouse in Georgia for their anniversary. I went over to speak at their anniversary, and I told that little story right there. And I said, you know, I said, I really feel good about being able to do that with her. One of the girls there came up to me afterwards, and I thought, I don't know anybody here, and I started running into people I knew. She said, you didn't know, did you? And I said, know what? She said, Louise passed away. And I had not seen her since I did that event. And if I had not taken that opportunity when I saw her right then, I would have never had that opportunity to set right that wrong. That was God giving me the opportunity to do it. I had to do it. I don't know why I felt that that was the need right then, but it tells me that I have to hold myself ready. If I can't get to somebody, I have to hold myself ready. If the opportunity presents itself, I got to do it. And you know what? I enjoy being sober, and I love my life today so much that I will do what it takes to do it. And it tells me in the book what I need to do. And when I get to steps 10, you know, I have to review that day. I've got to keep that stuff cleared out because, see, I don't like all that stuff I carried around. I don't like the emotions that went with it. I don't like the depression, and I don't like that feeling less than, and I don't like any of that stuff. And I've been able to work through that through these earlier steps. So I need to keep it there. And the only way I can do that is with that 10th step. And that 11th step, I get to keep my contact with God. I keep to get talking to God, and I keep to getting it deeper and deeper. And the book tells me there's other places I can go to keep seeking it. Because that step 12, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, that tells me I've only begun. An awakening is only a beginning. So if I'm only begun on that, then I got to go farther, and I have to do more. And I have to do more, you know. And that 12 steps says I have to work with others. Because, see, now I know what the solution is. And if I fail to tell you what the solution is when you're seeking it, it's my fault, not yours. That's just all there is to it, you know. And I don't want to take that kind of blame anymore. You know, God has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams today. Right quick, I want to share this real quick, too. Because when I was going through my sober time, when I got sober in 1997, I had never been sick. You know, I always drank away all my ills. I'd have a cold, I'd drink it away. I had a flu, I'd drink it away. Well, in 2000, I came down with cancer, and I did not know. But see, this is a program of mind, body, and soul. And so I've got to treat all three. And one of the things I had to do is start doing physicals. And I knew something was wrong, but I wouldn't go to the doctor, and I wouldn't tell Pauline. I was keeping that secret, you know. So I finally went to hear a speaker over in Sanford, and she was talked about being in her 30s and that she was diagnosed with cancer, and they said she was going to die, and that she's outlived three doctors since then. She was 82 when I heard her. So I went up to thank her after she spoke, and she said, "Child, you got something bothering you." She said, "What is resting on your soul?" And I just looked there, and I said, "I don't know." She says, "Do you have something to write on?" And I pulled out my little bitty big book that I had in my purse, and I handed it to her. She borrowed a pen from the guy behind her. She wrote down her name, Liz Bailey, and she wrote down her phone number, and she's from New York, and she wrote her sober day. And she said, "If you ever need to talk, you call me." She said, "It might take 24 hours to get back to you, but you call me." And I just took that, and I went over to the side, and I watched, because I wanted to see how many other people she gave her phone number to. I wanted to know what the deal was with her. And she didn't give it to anybody else. She handed the gentleman's pen back, and she didn't write down for anybody else. 3 days after I heard her at that meeting, I went to a doctor, and I was diagnosed. And they sent me to the cancer clinic in Orlando, and I had major surgery. I was out of work for 3 months, and I thought, well, God's good. They got it all. I didn't have to do chemo. I'm good to go, right? I get back to work. Everything starts getting back to normal in my life, and then that was in 2000, and in 2003, they found skin cancer. I thought it wouldn't be a big deal. We went in for the surgeries. It took 4 Mohairs in there, and I had to go back the next day for more, and they wound up taking half my face off, and I think I had 5 plastic surgeries after that to put it back, to get me a face again. And I just knew I wasn't going to have one. My insurance wouldn't cover the plastic surgery that I needed, but the doctor that I had was not the one I was supposed to get. The one I was supposed to get was out of town. They sent me to a new guy, and this guy refused to leave me like that. He kept me in surgery for an extra 4 or 5 hours rebuilding my face, and he didn't get paid for it because insurance didn't pay for it, and he never asked me to pay for it. But I have a face today. Thanks to that. And it's only by the God of my understanding putting me with the people I need to be with, and that I know. So after that, I came down with liver cancer right after that. I found out that I had hepatitis C, and I had hepatic tumors on my liver. And they diagnosed me and gave me about 3 months to live. And then they turned me down twice for a transplant. So Alverna, my sponsor, and another lady got together and put on a yard sale. Because they'd pull me out of work, and I didn't have anything. I had to keep my insurance going. Without insurance, I couldn't even get a chance of a liver transplant. And these ladies But it was absolutely awesome. They made enough. I've never seen that kind of money made at a yard sale. Because Alverna and Pauline and Val had turned around and they let everybody know that this was for somebody that was trying to get a transplant. And people would go up to buy, this one lady went up to buy a $5 tent. And she gave Alverna 50 and told her to put the rest of it up. And all day long I'd walk by and Alverna go, "You don't know what I know. You don't know what I know." And I'd say, "Well, tell me. Later. You don't know what I know." And I would get this all, and I just kept going. I didn't know what was going on. That was the day I found out she was married to Bill Oakley. Because, see, I didn't know she was married to Bill Oakley. I had been avoiding him for 8 years because he was too sober. I would run and sit in the back of the room to hear every word he said, but I was too scared to go talk to him. So I'm standing there with her. Bill comes up, and all of a sudden he leans over and he kisses her, and he walks away, and I said, "Bill Oakley just kissed you." And she goes, "Yeah." I said, "That was Bill Oakley." She says, "I know." She said, "I wake up next to him every morning." And I was like blown out of the water on that. And I just sat down. I didn't know what to say. But it was, you know, it was an amazing time in my life. Because even with what I was going through at this amazing time, I had people around me that were so giving and so warm and so caring. And that's what this fellowship has done for me. And while I was in the hospital up there for 2 months, Pauline would get up there to see me. Alverna would write to me. I mean, I got to stay connected even though I was engaged, you know. And it was just amazing, amazing how that worked for me. So, you know, is there any wonder I would do anything I have to do to be able to stay a part of this fellowship and this program? It's an absolute miracle for me just to even be here. And I'm so grateful for that I take that with me on every single day. When I get up, my prayer for the day when I get up in the morning is, "Thank you for giving me another day." Because I'm not supposed to have it. I'm not supposed to be here. But I am here. And I don't even question why. I'm just grateful for it. And that's about all I have. I'm back here from North Carolina. I went up there to take care of my dad when he was sick. And I stayed up there to be with my kids and take care of his stuff. And now it's time for me to get back here where my family is. This is where I got sober, and this is where I belong. So thank you so much for inviting me, Alverna, and thank you all for listening. Yay.